Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from recent and archived issues of the journal. This month, associate editors Sam Kilmeyer and Zach Yanowitz sit down with poet Lauren Haldeman, whose book Instead of Dying won the 2017 Colorado Prize for Poetry and was published by the Center for Literary Publishing. Lauren visited Colorado State to give a reading at the end of January. Stay tuned.
Okay. Let's podcast. I'm Sam Kilmeyer, an assistant editor at Colorado Review and intern at the Center for Literary Publishing. And today I'm here with fellow intern Zach Yanowitz.
Hello.
To chat with poet Lauren Haldeman, author of Instead of Dying, the winner of the Colorado Prize for Poetry in 2017. Thanks for being here, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
How's your time in Fort Collins been so far?
We've been loving it. We went and checked out downtown and all the places I've seen very kid-friendly and dog-friendly, and we have both with us. So,
I feel like in terms of topography, it's probably pretty similar to Iowa.
I mean, except for we don't have like a giant mountain next to us. It's it feels like Iowa City, and then you like look past the buildings and you're like, wait, no. And also it seems to be maybe four or five times the size of Iowa City as well. So, but it definitely, as soon as I came here, I felt at home. Like, you know, it's the same sort of vibe and feel of where I live. So
cool. All right, so you did a reading last night. How'd you feel about that?
I was pretty nervous, as I am usually before all readings. Mostly I'm just afraid I'm going to throw up or faint. I don't know why. That's never happened, but every single reading, that's my worry. And it didn't happen, so I consider that a success.
Well, it's good to have something on the line.
Yeah, that's what it is. If I can get through without fainting or throwing up, then yeah.
it was really well attended. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about the game that you had audience members play?
Oh, yeah. So I tend to try to add things to my poetry readings to sort of break up the time, especially since I know that most people, including myself, I generally have like at most a 15-minute window of time that I can pay attention to one thing. And so I do a game with this book where there's two sections in the book that are lines from that I had written down that my daughter was saying, and also lines that I was writing down from my own self and also from different things that I was learning throughout the process. And I mixed them together into these small sort of singular poems. And the game is that an audience member comes up and tries to guess if a child wrote the line or an adult. And usually they get it pretty spot on. So, but
there
sometimes
are,
it's
there are some ones that were kind of a toss-up.
Yeah, there are some ones that usually the toss-up is that people think a child wrote it and it was really me that wrote it. So I don't know what I feel about that, but it's a fun game. I've got like a card that says child and a card that says adult, and they hold it up after each line. And there's no way to lose. Everyone gets a broadside. Who plays?
So. It was very well received, I thought.
Yeah, and an excellent prize.
Yeah, so. Right on. You know, we got to give out some prizes.
Yeah, that's great. I think it was the first poetry reading I've been at where prizes were awarded.
I think it should be part of every poetry reading from here on out. People love prizes.
I was going to say, in general, people respond well to being bribed.
Yeah, and I've listened, you know, in other podcasts and other like live, like stage shows for radio, you know, they bring people up, the audience are part of it. And so I thought that'd be a good idea to try for you know, poetry as well.
One of our fellow CLP interns was talking about you having a background in puppetry.
I do, yeah. I spent about three summers up in Vermont with the Bread and Puppet Theater in Glover. And I was up there for about probably 3 months at a time learning. They do all sorts of forms of puppetry up there, but the one that really I was drawn to was called a cranky, which is just a box with like a scroll of drawings, and you just turn the scroll. It's like a primitive TV. And I started making these scrolls to go along with poems that I had written. And then I would memorize the poem and perform the cranky. It's super fun to do. It's kind of a hard thing to get around, like especially on a plane. So this year I had to take it out to, I had an artist in residency up in Wells College in Aurora, New York. And so I took it apart and I made all these like hinged contraptions so that I could put it into like a baseball bat bag. And then I brought that on the plane and then I construct it again when I get there. So
I imagine that might be kind of hard to explain to the TSA.
You know, they let me through without even a question. It's a basketball bag full of pieces of wood with like and dowels.
You don't understand. It's for poems.
It's a puppetry thing. Haven't you heard of these? And they're like, yeah.
You don't see these every day?
Yeah, you don't see these every single day in a baseball bat bag. That's, yeah, it's like, no. But they didn't stop me. I mean, they must see weirder stuff than that, which, I don't know, whatever.
That's true. The TSA does have a great Instagram account where they just post things they confiscate.
Are you serious?
It's a surprisingly high number of ninja weapons.
Of course. Why would you bring a ninja weapon? Oh, man.
Intricate.
All right.
I gotta follow that account for sure.
It's a good one. All right, Lauren, do you want to dive into the book and read a couple poems for us?
I'm going to read the first two poems. And these are about my brother, who passed away 5 years ago, so. Instead of dying, you move in with us. We fix the basement up with a shower and a small area for your bed, and you come to live. I help you carry boxes down the stairs. We set up your record player. We hang up your old poster from fifth grade that says, Save the Wolves. Once a week, you make grilled cheese for us in the upstairs kitchen. Instead of dying, instead of being stabbed on the street in Denver, instead of bleeding to death surrounded by strangers neither you nor I will ever meet, instead of all that, you get a job at the local grocery store, stocking the shelves, watering the produce, collards, endive, grapefruit. Your face stays your face, and your pain gets better, and you swim at the rec center in the early light of spring, and you are so not dead. And then they get more and more fantastical as they move through the book. This is the next one. Instead of dying, they inject you with sunlight and you live. It is a highly experimental process developed in the deep caverns of Luray, where a fluid from the crevasses of a previous Earth is found to contain a slow conglomerate of sunlight. Scientists discover they can separate the plasma into a medicinal dose, a shot of which can bring a boy back from death after being stabbed 3 times in the chest. The Belt of Orion, they call it, and it works. The moment the needle goes into your arm, you open your eyes. The bright light enters your bloodstream. And we thank the doctors and the ambulance drivers and even the man who did this to you, since he provided us with the opportunity to infuse you with infinite illumination. So, those are two from the sections that are basically kind of like small prose poems. And I'll read the one right after that, too. It's pretty short. I wanted to, while I was writing these, I was writing in a tiny little notebook, and I noticed I usually just start writing at the end of the day just to fill up the page because I want to get it over with. And I noticed that I was starting a lot of the pages with the phrase, instead of dying. I was writing about Ryan. And as soon as I noticed that, I thought I should make it official. Obviously, something was going on. I was trying, you know, with my writing to sort of separate the magical thinking that I was having in my head about him and making it actually officially fiction on the page. Because after he died, I had a lot of moments where I would think something like, oh, you know, I should tell Ryan about this like new like diet where you don't eat, you know, bread, and maybe that will help. And then I'll think like, oh my God, he's dead. Like, what am I doing? Why am I planning like, I would think, I should call Ryan and let him know that this is coming up. And then I would think, oh my God, he's dead. So it was hard to, every time I had the realization that he was dead, it would be that same shock, almost like the first time I heard from my, you know, when my mom called to let me know. And I didn't like that shock. I mean, no one does. It's pretty debilitating and painful. So I thought I need to, one, catch my brain up with reality so that we're no longer stuck in a different world. And we're also no longer kind of like wishing different things. And writing all that stuff down was a way to sort of separate it from reality, but also have it be there to respect it, you know? All of these things I wish would have happened for him instead of, you know, what did happen, the story we didn't want. So this is one that was a little sillier. You know, I tried to go between like really fantastical, really weird things that I actually think he would have done. So instead of dying, you adopt 100 cats, and then you adopt one more cat, and then you adopt the next cat. You adopt all the cats. At night, your apartment rattles with claws and fur. On the back of each cat, you place a small monitor to measure their purring, and then you synchronize their purring. Knowing full well that cats dream our lives, you also synchronize their sleep. You amass them all into a bevy of knowing, coaxing their alpha waves into clear veins of telepathy. When they are asleep, it is high consciousness, the grandest meditation. When they are awake, it is mostly chaos. Just trying to picture, you know, different things that could have happened.
I think one of the things that I noticed, I think everyone notices when they read this collection for the first time, is how it's obviously, you know, a devastating work, but I kept laughing out loud.
Yeah.
And feeling guilty that I was laughing out loud. Yeah. But then I just kept laughing. It's a really, really funny book.
Yeah.
But it's just not a funny subject material at all.
Right.
And I was wondering whether injecting humor into the poems was something intentional when you were writing them, or whether it just kind of came out as a byproduct of...
I mean, I think that humor and comedy and silliness is kind of like a survival technique. You know, we as humans, we have dark humor. And for me and my brother, for me and Ryan especially, we used silliness, and my other brother James, as siblings, we would use silliness and jokes to sort of comfort ourselves during stressful events or stressful times or sad times. And so it's just was my kind of a natural instinct to continue to try to find silliness in the world. There was a point very early on where I thought I wouldn't ever feel joy again. And I asked my grief counselor, I said to him, I said, I'm worried I'm not going to ever feel joy again. And he had me, I had a coffee next to me during the session. He had me take a sip of the coffee and he said, describe it to me. And I love coffee. I was like, it's warm. It's like I can feel it in my stomach. It tastes good. It's so... And he was like, there's joy. There is joy right there. And I realized that even in all of this crazy, tragic stuff that woven into each minute and each hour and each day were also really odd, funny things and also really comforting, joyful things. And it really changed my perspective on all of life, too. Like, I feel a lot less fearful now because I know that even when something like this happens, which is, I mean, one of the more horrible things you can imagine happening, that we survive, you know, if we're able to pay attention and honor, you know, our emotions and honor the full range of feelings and not check out and not drink and not, you know, drug our way into oblivion. And our bodies and our minds have this ability, you know, to actually handle these things and come out the other side feeling more joy. So,
did you find that writing this collection helped with that process?
It did. You know, like I didn't consider writing part of my my grief work for a long time. I was really doing basic things like making sure that when I needed to cry, I cry, making sure that I paid attention to emotions going through my body, making sure I exercised and took good care of myself. But you know, a year or two in, I realized that writing was really part of the process too. And I was discovering things that I didn't know that were subconscious, and they were coming up through the writing. And the writing was hard. It felt awful doing it. But at the end, it was almost like you know, when you feel sick and you vomit and feel better, like that's what a lot of these felt like. Like I would get done writing it. It would feel terrible doing it and thinking about it. And then I'd feel like lighter and I'd feel a little like there was a little more space there than there was before.
One of my favorite poems in the collection is one of the mirror poems in the second section. Not the mirror poems, the numbered lists.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what, if you have a name for that specific form.
I call it mirror poems.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I believe I made them up. I'm not sure. Okay. It was a form that I sort of accidentally stumbled upon one day while editing and trying to see what I could do with, I was trying to number all the lines by 20, and they didn't look right being left aligned on the page. It just kind of looked boring. So I right aligned it, and all of a sudden I saw this possibility. You know, I was writing in a notebook, and I was like, oh, well, what if this was like, what's that test where you press the ink?
Oh, the litmus test?
You put ink on one side of a paper.
The Rorschach
one. Yeah, yeah. And then you make a shape, and you're supposed to see. And I thought this could be like that. Like I could make like this weird... Mm-hmm. alternate version and then edit that to see what comes up, and it's always surprising. So
earlier you asked if Sam and I had any particular poems that we wanted you to read, and we said no, but I've changed my mind.
Oh, okay. You want me to read this one? Both of them?
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that the one with the remembering at the end?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah, this is
one of my favorites.
temperature is a product of being embodied. It is a measurement that exists only because of objects. It is a comfortable old hurt, the return of a radar blip, like how I leave a voicemail on my dead brother's phone, how I text my dead brother, I miss you, and then delete it. What makes me do this? It is not a good idea. I feel weird for whole days afterward. Then the feeling turns into another feeling, and I forget. Only this poem makes me remember. What a great poem. Thanks, poem. Do you want me to read the other side?
Yeah,
okay.
Might as well.
Produce a temperature body and be. Exit that measurement and become an object. Because only hurt holds comfort. Is it a blip or the radar's return of a blip? Mail me his voice leaving. Phone my brother's deadness to me. I'm texting my dead brother, I miss you. I make what it deletes. The idea of God is not a doing, this weird feeling, warding away days, whole intuition of feeling, then forgetting. Feeling another one made this poem, this one only remembers. So my poem is great, but what help is it, verily? And I had actually done this, I had called his phone. I don't know why, this is really weird instinct. Just wanting to talk with him again or, you know, have one last contact. And I'm like tearing up right now. And I knew writing it down would make me remember it. Like, it's a weird poem because it's like I don't want to remember doing this, but the poem's there. So there became this whole question of like, what do I keep, you know? And what is a poem's like job, you know, especially for the writer, like when we like put something down on paper and decide to like keep it and make it part of history, like what are we saving and what are we not? And I had a lot of trouble with this poem because I really didn't want to keep this memory alive, but I decided to do it. I was like, let's do it. Let's keep this memory alive. And it's interesting because it always reminds me that, like, this morning's going to be, like, lifelong, you know? But there'll be, like, different phases of it, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think I definitely understand that impulse. I've certainly called people's phones to hear their voice on the voicemail.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the things I like best about that poem is how it's so self-aware that what it's doing is a bad idea.
Yeah, it's like such a bad idea.
But it can't help but do it, and that's
the
part that's important.
You know, and I still have his contact on my phone. Like, I just can't delete it. So, and it's such a weird thing that technology does, too. It keeps, you know, it just, it doesn't know. My phone doesn't know. that he's not there anymore, you know. But someone it's probably someone else's number by now.
When my grandmother died, my mom did the same thing and, like, sent her a text at one point, which was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And then the person who had gotten my grandmother's number responded.
Yeah.
And my mom just had this, like, hour-long period at, like, 3 a.m. where she, like, kind of thought that she was talking to her mother's ghost.
Yeah.
And, again, this was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But
you gotta do it.
There's a reason that every, you know, it's part of the process.
Yeah. And in a way, you know, outside of the phone and the technology, I do feel like I'm in contact with Ryan a lot. And I feel like I'm in contact with my dad. My dad passed away about 2.5 years ago. I feel many times closer to him than I did when he was alive in a body. It's weird because when he was alive in a body, like, there were actual distances between us because when you're embodied, you're in space and time. And I don't feel distances between us anymore. So it's very weird. But yeah, that poem's a rough one. That was one of the ones that was hard for me to edit. There's another one that's really hard for me to read and edit. But, you know, that's the process of this book. So when I'm done with all the touring and podcasts and stuff, I may just take a break, like, for a year from, you know, just... It's a lot of work too to
right.
be with it over and over.
And
so.
Have people ask you about it on podcasts. It's all the
totally
time.
Yeah. I mean, I love talking about
like
him,
you should have
and
written
I love
such
talking.
A brilliant book
I know,
already.
Right? Damn it. Yeah. Like, sorry, getting cussed on the podcast. You can bleep that out. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, and like you know, and the people around me who love me are have you know. Are like, you need to take breaks, you need to take care of yourself. And I'm like, no, it's just a book, I'm just talking. And then, you know, of course.
You start talking and you
yeah, and you're like, oh, God, yeah, so.
Being alive is really hard.
Being alive is tough. It takes courage just to be alive. We forget that, you know? We think it should be easy, but it's not.
I think it's interesting how we're talking in lots of different ways about what a poem can do, like from those first ones, the imagining.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just so imaginative, and they become really playful and childlike kind of in their imagery. And then the mirror poems, how, like, the language kind of breaks apart and becomes something new.
Yeah.
But also now, like, that you're doing this book tour and speaking with us, how the poem is doing, like, this new thing that you might not have imagined at the beginning. So one of my questions was, like, how has that process changed for you along the journey of publication and now on your book tour?
The process of being with the poems or what process?
Yeah, or like what they've been doing for you and seeing what they're doing for other people. Like,
yeah, I mean,
they're so personal, but now they're public.
Right. They're, you know, and I see them as one thing because I wrote them as one thing. So it's really interesting to watch other people find other stuff in them. And to find out that other people have different favorites than mine. I mean, I have favorites in here, and then people write me about other ones, and I'm like, how could that one be your favorite? So I like that. I've also had a lot of people come up to me and reveal that, you know, they had lost someone recently. A surprising number of women who have lost brothers, and I don't know what that is. And so... That doesn't upset me. I think that of that as sort of a circumstance that's been created for me to be able to help a little bit. I reached out for help from like so many people when this happened. I had no idea what to do, and so many people stepped up and gave me bits of advice. I mean, they didn't sit down with me for hours, but they would say something that would resonate. I ran into one of my friends, Tammy, at a grocery store one time, and I was, in the beginning, I would go, Iowa City's great because it's like a community. In the beginning, I would go out and I would just cry in public. Something would set me off, and I saw Tammy there, and I said, what are you up to, you know? And she's like, oh, I'm going to go visit my brother, and I just lost my, and she gave me a hug. And she said, I want you to look around you. And we, you know, it was a busy grocery store. And she said, we're all the walking wounded. She said, there's pain everywhere. Everyone has lost someone. You're surrounded by the walking wounded. And it sounds like a terrible thing to say, but it made me feel less alone. And I think that's like a really valuable part of this too, because when something like this happens, you feel really alone, especially after the first few weeks, because everyone goes back to their own lives and you're not there yet. So little bits like that, my therapist saying, when I drink the coffee, there's the joy, like that carries on. And so when people come up to me and share stuff like that, I really try to, you know, remember phrases or remember things that helped me. Another thing that really helped me was people just kept saying, take care of yourself. And it just didn't occur to me to, I had to work on my self-love a lot. It didn't occur to me that that was important, that I take care of myself. And it ended up being one of the most important things, especially because I'm a mom. So I also needed to be there for my daughter. But yeah, I continually have to remind myself to be gentle with myself, to be kind, to take breaks. I'm sober. I don't drink or do any drugs or anything like that anymore. I buy a lot of coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. I drink a lot of chai and tea, and I eat a lot of candy. I eat a lot of ice cream. I just try to remember to be really kind to myself and things that make me feel good, you know, like exercising or laughing or, you know, just laying down. There's one book in here or one poem in here that says, laying down is the only drug I have left. And it's so true. Like, laying down is so amazing. So I try to do all those things, and I try to pass that on to the people who share these losses. So, and there's a lot of them. People, you know, this is part of our being alive, is losing things. And we know how to do it as animals. We just have to remember that we know how to do it. Our brains get in the way.
Moving away from that a little bit, there's a section in the middle of the collection that I don't think you read any poems from it last night.
Right.
The section in the middle that's all about astronomers.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites in the book.
Even oh, really?
It feels a little bit separated from the rest of the content. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit to how you feel that section fits into the rest of the collection.
Yeah, so that section was written as a chapbook about 2 years after Ryan passed. I was working with an amazing artist and letterpress artist and bookmaker named Candida Pagan. And she asked me basically to write 8 poems based on these different scientists who made these discoveries around heliocentricity, where the sun is placed and where we are in the universe. And at that time, part of my mourning process was I found a lot of spirituality through science. I don't know why. Science kind of just blows my mind, like the way everything is set up, that there are like minuscule tiny things we'll never see. And then there are like planets that are like 500 times the size of our planet. Like, I can't even imagine that coming into our orbit. I also was really, you know, interested in the idea of like how human beings have an idea of their world and then it changes through scientific discoveries, and how painful that is for an entire society to have that change. It's another type of loss. I mean, your idea of yourself is... it's very scary if that changes. And that's what was happening with each one of these discoveries, is, and these people were being, you know, prosecuted and killed because of how painful it was to have that whole self-identity change. So I started writing those, and she made an artist book out of them. I found I was more interested in a lot of times in the story of the actual scientist, the actual astronomer, and how society reacted, than I was to the science behind the what they were actually figuring out. But I liked how it sort of wove together with the death poems, because I was just in this space where I was realizing, like, I don't know. Like, we don't know. Like, we have all these scientific discoveries and we still don't know. We just don't know where Ryan is. You know, I don't know where my dad is. I don't know where I was before I was born. I mean, I was somewhere, maybe not I, but some, you know, and I felt like those worked really well in the middle as sort of this solid piece, but it also sort of pulled away from the more personal stuff. I mean, the book can get pretty heavy at times, and so I liked pairing that in there as sort of a centerpiece, a ballasting of bringing in these other characters throughout history. And they're, I mean, a lot of those stories are super sad.
The one about Tycho, is it Brahe or Bray?
I think it's Tycho Brahe, yeah.
Tycho Brahe, the one about him and Kepler.
Yeah.
The poems, I love those poems because they're so, like, tender and intimate and personal on the one sense, like, between the astronomers, but, like, the concepts that they're describing are just, like, the absolute thematic opposite of that.
Yeah, they're distant.
And enormous.
And enormous. And those two, their relationship was very interesting to me. And it's one of those relationships that we all, I think, have in our lives that are this mixture of just destruction and creation and love and hate and, you know, these incredible connections that we make. And then Galileo's story is just, like he was imprisoned and then separated from his only daughter. And that really hit me too, you know, so... I liked bringing in some other characters so it wasn't just me, which, you know, sometimes poetry can be just a lot of me. I'm not, you know.
I personally love the me poems.
Oh, okay, good.
Well, but also, I liked, like, the For Me the Star poems, or I thought of them as, like, star poems.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle, because then they kind of, like, spiraled out into the, like, prose poems, and then Instead of Dying. And
yeah.
That one that you read earlier about the Belt of Orion.
Yeah.
For me, I was like, oh, the Belt of Orion also, like, returns near the end in
it
a
does.
Different way.
Yeah.
And then that, like, I don't know, it wove through the center in a really interesting way that expanded.
Thanks.
Yeah. It also, I want to talk before we go, I feel like we're nearing towards the end of things, but I wanted to, like, ask you about your cover art, too.
Oh, yeah.
And how you were thinking about, like, that imagery, because to me, it reminded me of the, like, Belt of Orion, but that was just my personal reading of it.
So, right up, after Ryan died, I had a lot of friends contact me and say, I mean, everyone was giving suggestions, and some suggestions were to use my art and my writing to sort of process it. Mm-hmm. And my initial reaction to that was like, that's insane. There's no way that this could touch something so large. But my friends, being who they are, forced me into it.
Friends,
they're the worst. They're always right.
I was loving you.
I know, and asking you to do things that'll help you.
What jerks.
I know. One of my friends at Jubilat asked me to do a cover for their next issue. And suggested maybe have it be something about Ryan. And so I set about to put together this. Ryan loved wolves, and we sort of loved these idea of these characters that are part human, part animal. This is how I represent Ryan now, with a wolf head, wearing a vest. He would wear vests. He has this other jacket that he sometimes wears in my drawings, but he, the night before he died, we actually talked on the phone that night before he left to go downtown Denver. And he asked me to make him I make masks and as well. And he asked me to make him a wolf mask. And I'm an older sister, and I had noticed that I was almost 2 years sober at that time, and I noticed that he was drinking a lot as well. And so I said, oh, well, how about you go to a couple AA meetings, and then I'll make you the mask as a, like, present, which I hate now that I said. I just should have said, yeah, I'll make you a mask. We talked, he hung up the phone, he went downtown, and he was killed. So I draw him like this now, kind of as this, like, he has the mask, you know, he's, and it's a powerful sort of persona. I see him as, you know, victorious and strong with this wolf head. Painting this and making this art was extremely painful. I had a table set up in the basement where I would, we've got a small house, so there's not a lot of space, and I would just draw down there, and I knew that I needed to keep doing this, working on it, because every time I'd get near the basement stairs, I'd feel sick. And I thought, that's a sign that I need to go towards this and not avoid it. So it was another instance of finishing a project and feeling release, but hating it while I was doing it because it was so painful. I initially painted it on wood, and then when they contacted me about the prize and asked me for ideas for covers, I remembered, you know, years ago making this. I took out the wood background and kind of cleaned it up a little bit and changed it. I added some more of these sort of dashes of energy, and it came together really well. I worked with the designer here. It was with, wait, you. That's right. Okay. And you figured out this whole, you know, I kind of wanted like a hand.
Yeah, the one that is on your letter. Yeah. Broadside.
Yeah.
It looks the same kind of font.
And I love the font that you found because it looks kind of cut out almost, but hand done. And I think we, this was like one of the, this was the first iteation, and maybe we changed like the spacing between like the Y and the D or something. I forget.
So it was something very small.
It's the only one that I saw. Usually for covers for books here, we go through like 5 or 10 options. Yeah. But for this book, we got this cover and it was like, we pretty much nailed it.
I mean, yeah. And you kind of like brought this over to the back. And so what's so interesting is when I got these in the mail, I took them out. I put them on next to my pile of my first book, Calendar. And they're like, what's this called?
The spine?
Yeah, even the spine like matches the other book in this weird way. I think because really? I do these dashes
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, got those kind of like bright,
dashes,
bright colors.
Yeah.
Like green.
And so I, you know, and I see them sort of as like, you know, they're siblings now, those two books. So thank you so much. I can't believe I forgot that. I'm mixing everyone up here.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay. Almost like
never
met
actually
a ton
met
of people
other.
In
yeah,
the last 18
exactly.
hours.
Yeah.
I expected to remember all
on
of
a
them.
Very small amount of sleep, so.
Yeah, I just really loved the art, and you really had a complete idea before sending it to us, which is something also that doesn't usually happen.
Oh,
it's like
okay.
I think I would like a wolf or like a sheep or something.
Well, I use Photoshop like and Illustrator a lot for my job and also for, you know, my artwork, and so I tend to overdo things. And I think I sent you a PSD file with like multiple layers, and like I divided it up into text and artwork. Like I was like, let me do all the work for you. So which,
the background was already cut out from your photo too.
Oh yeah, I'd already gone through and cut image. Those and moved those around. So the original one, you know, Jubilat actually looks a lot different. It really is two different pieces of art. Because the Jubilat one just kind of goes up, and I had cut out and added more of the dots. So,
It's nice to work with designers.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love the whole, the image is beautiful. And I like hearing you talk about what you think of those dots or how you think about them.
Yeah, you know,
as, like,
I
dots
see.
Of energy.
Energy was a good way to
energy.
Phrase it.
I love that. Because it
you
does
know,
have such energy and movement.
Like, this is kind of like the blood coming out, and then this is like his spirit going up. Mm-hmm. So there's like two directions happening at once. And this is both him, you know, standing, looking up, and also, you know, dying, so.
Yeah, it reminds me of my favorite poem, which maybe we could read one more.
Okay, sure.
Or another one if there's something else you want to read.
Which one?
It's the one about where you're imagining the stars in the ceiling and the different types of energy.
Yeah, okay.
You read it, I think, last night.
I did, yeah. I'll read that one.
Maybe a good sign off.
Okay, great. Yeah. Instead of dying, you simply choose to stop moving your body. You decide to occupy alternate structures of metaphysical space instead, and we at first are understandably confused. One night, you take the form of rainbow dots scattered and sparkling on our ceiling. You seem to be able to be everywhere at once. After a while, we don't know what to do with your body, which is still breathing beneath a willow tree near the Goodwill. You become more and more elusive, sublime. At one point in the final days before you enter some undetectable sphere and completely disappear, you attempt to show me a section of multidimensional activity. Watch how all the realities intermingle, you say. Look at the way they merge and coalesce. But it is too much for me. My own embodiment isn't ready.
Well, that was lovely. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
To the studio and for sharing your work with us, Lauren.
Thank you.
Really lovely.
Great.
You can learn more about Lauren Haldeman and her work at laurenhaldeman.com. Instead of Dying is out now through the Center for Literary Publishing. You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or find us on the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.